Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I'm married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And that's the big question. Do you want to change whatever it is that is bugging you about yourself? Hi, I'm Carol the Coach, and I am here talking with you today about hope, strength, and recovery. This is the show about addiction. In particular, it is about sexual addiction. And tonight we've got a very special guest. We have Alan J. Katz on, and he's going to be talking about an issue that has plagued so many of my clients. And that issue, believe it or not, well, yes, it's sexual addiction, but it's also workaholism. Now, what we know to be true about any kind of addiction is that usually it's fused with a second or third or fourth addiction. And so what that entails is that, let's say you're an alcoholic. When you stop the alcoholism, more than likely the sexual addiction goes out of control. If you stop the sexual addiction and you don't treat their marijuana addiction, you more than likely smoke more marijuana to cope with stopping the sexual addiction. You know, they're all medications. They all numb feelings, and they all keep you from really identifying with your needs, with your authentic self, and who you truly were meant to be. Now, I happen to know this topic very well because I consider myself a workaholic. And some of you who have listened to the show have heard some of my stories. But truly, I try not to talk too much about myself because this show is all about you. If you have a question and you want to talk, that number is 646-595-3284. So put me on your speed dial. Again, that number is 646-595-3284. But tonight, this show is going to be all about my personal story and why I so much believe in this topic. And then an ebook that Alan Katz wrote called Addictive Entrepreneurship: How to Achieve Success with the Character Traits You Already Have. So it should be a very fascinating show. If you yourself are a workaholic, you'll enjoy it. If you know somebody who's a workaholic, you'll find it fascinating. And if you want to get to know me better, hey, This is the way to do it. I got to tell you, I have always been an overachiever. That might be, well, that might explain why I get up at 5 on Mondays. Well, I get up at 5 every day, but on Mondays I get up at 5, and I do something a little bit unusual in that I make my toughest, longest day on Mondays. Why? So I can kind of get it out of the way. And two, because I'm a believer that, you know, after a couple days off, or at least one day off, I have the most energy on Monday, so I can give the most. And as I said before, I've always been an overachiever, and I've always loved what I did. Whether that was high school, whether that was college, whether it was my internships or my jobs, I have always had a passion for helping people and for assisting them in change as well as achieving the most that I could out of life. And if any of you have ever gone to my website, www.carolthecoach.com, you'll see that I'm on television. Actually, if you're in the Indianapolis area, I'll be on television tomorrow, Channel 13, doing a segment on the sandwich generation. I do radio shows both on radio stations and also on the Internet. And I'm always working on a certification. Right now I'm doing eye movement desensitization reprocessing, which is EMDR, and it helps trauma victims to reprocess their memories and move on in their life. Obviously, I'm the only certified sexual addictions therapist in the Indianapolis area. Really felt the need to do that. I've been certified to be a personal life and executive coach. You know, with coaching, you didn't have to get your education. You didn't have to get your certification. But I always wanted to do that. I write a blog for the Meadows and help them to get the word out about sexual addiction. I have a blog on my own website. I have two websites. My other website is Sex Help with Carol the Coach, named after this show, although I started the website first. And one of the reasons I've always been an overachiever is because it produces dopamine in my brain. That's very common to any addiction that you have, will typically produce dopamine and different neurotransmitters that light up the brain and create that reward center. As well as I enjoyed the praise that I got from people and used it to validate me. And I can remember, back as an intern, I'm 57 now, but when I was 21, 22, my supervisor sat me down and he said, "Carol, you are such a ball of energy and you give so much. And, you know, having you here is the equivalent of having three students here. You get that much done. But if you don't slow down, by the time you're 30, you will have burnt out." And at the time, I thought to myself, oh, this man does not know my energy. I'm not going to burn out. And I got to tell you, I didn't burn out. I have never, ever had an experience with depression or burnout. I think in part because I love what I do so much. However, it wasn't until I started training for my sexual addiction when I was studying under the great Dr. Patrick Carnes, the guru of sexual addiction. He wanted us to take a test, and I didn't feel that I had any addictions. And he said, "Carol, how is it that you don't have any addictions?" And I offhandedly said, "Well, you know, if I have an addiction, it's work. I'm a person that ascribes to the philosophy, work hard, play hard." And he said to me, "Well, tell me a little bit more about that." And I said, "Well, I get up at 5, I go to bed at about midnight. I see about 50 clients a week. I run 1, 2, or 3 groups, depending on the schedule. I have a radio show. I'm on TV. I can't get enough work. And he said, how are your relationships? And I said, oh, Dr. Carnes, my relationships are wonderful. I said, I have girlfriend night every Thursday night. I never miss. I honor it 100%. My husband and I have two date nights, and when I worked on Saturday nights at the radio station, we'd make sure to do movies when I got home at 10:30. We go to church. We exercise together. I exercise alone and together. You know, I get my exercise in. I make jewelry. I play guitar. You know, I just went on and on about all the incredible activities that I'm a part of. And he stopped me, and he said, you know, Carol, I got to tell you something about yourself. He said, nobody can sustain that schedule without it affecting something. And, you know, when a great master speaks, you'd be silly not to listen. So I said, go on, Dr. Carnes. And this is in front of the entire class as I'm getting certified. And he said, you know, there are three things that occur when you keep yourself that busy. He said, the first thing is, how many days do you work a week? And I said, oh, sometimes seven, at least six. And, you know, I typically put in 10-hour days at least five of the days, maybe three and a half. And he said, Carol, when you see that many clients, your brain does not get to rest. And the brain has to rest to rejuvenate. And I get that you're doing fine and you haven't burned out and you're not sick, but you're not doing your brain a favor. And I heard that and I thought about it. And then he said, secondly, I get that you have date night and you have girlfriends that you go out with. And he said, but trust me, your relationships are suffering because you're not spending enough downtime to replenish to be able to give your relationships what you need to give them. And I kind of thought about that, and I said to myself, you know, this guy's kind of right, because when I get home after a long day at work, I'm not particularly tired, but I don't want to get on the phone. I don't want to text anybody. Excuse me. I am probably not as available to my loved ones as I need to be. So I heard that, and I believed it 100%. And then the third thing he said to me was, you know, what kind of a therapist are you? And I said, well, actually, Dr. Carnes, I'm one of the best in the city. I probably have the greatest reputation in Indianapolis. I've worked really hard at media and writing columns, and I've been in our Indianapolis paper for 5 years. I work hard, and it pays. It shows. And he said, well, Carol, let me tell you something about yourself. You are not as good of a therapist as you think you are, because nobody can be that on that pace and do the job that they think they're accomplishing. Okay, so he told me those three things. And remember, he said, your brain needs to rest. You don't give to your relationships what you need to. And last but not least, you're not that good of a therapist. And I said, you know, I can kind of believe you, Dr. Carnes. I feel like this is a wake-up call, and I trust you. And what would you suggest? And he said, well, if I were you, I'd go to Workaholics Anonymous in Indianapolis when you get home. And I said, well, I'll do that, Dr. Carnes. I would love to do that. And when I got home to Indianapolis after my certification, would you believe there were no Workaholics Anonymous groups? And I said to myself, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have to start a group. And so my husband starts to yell, and he says, oh, my gosh, you mean you're going to have to be the leader of this group and get it started? Isn't that contraindicated? And we giggled together, and we knew that probably that was going to need to occur. So that's a little bit about me and about workaholism. And, again, I want to talk to you about the fact that Alan J. Katz wrote Addictive Entrepreneurship, How to Achieve Success with the Character Traits You Already Have. And we are so happy to have him on the show. So welcome, Mr. Katz. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am wonderful. And, wow, this is a book that speaks directly to me. And a lot of my clients that suffer with addictions actually also have the addictive qualities of workaholism. So I'm excited to be talking about this with you. And this is an e-book available that you have written. And how can people get this e-book as they listen to you talk? If they're interested in buying this book, how do they do that?
On my website, allanjkatz.com. It's allanjkatz.com.
Okay, and so they can buy that in e-book.
Not in e-book form or in paperback.
Wonderful. Okay, so tell me, what is your definition of workaholism?
Well, my definition of workaholism, I think first we have to talk about what addiction is itself. And I believe that work can be addictive in both a positive and negative way. In order to succeed, a person has to have a drive to succeed coupled with enthusiasm. But when this drive and enthusiasm turns into obsessive or compulsive work ethic, it leads to work addiction, meaning that anytime that work affects our social, personal, or spiritual life in a negative way, you know, when we're not there to go to our kids' ball games because we're working, or we take work home and we're not present, you know, then that becomes a problem and it starts to affect our social and personal lives and spiritual lives. And then there's also, we begin to doubt our own ability to accomplish our passion. You know, fear of failure comes in, even fear of success, that causes us to medicate. And we, so a lot of times we'll medicate with work.
Yeah, and I often find that it's kind of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. But when I'm working with people who have addictions, particularly sexual addictions, because that's my expertise, oftentimes they work so hard during the day that when they come home, they feel like they deserve to relax with an addiction. Mm-hmm. And so it's hard to know which feeds what because it's auto-exacerbating. And it seems like, okay, well, they definitely work hard, so then they treat themselves with whatever addiction they choose. Then they feel shame and they want to work hard to, as you said, increase that drive to succeed. Mm-hmm. And so it can be a very vicious cycle.
Well, the two addictions, sex addiction and workaholism, are very similar because a lot of times people at work will get bored with what they're doing. And, you know, since they're right there on the computer, sometimes they'll just turn right to the Internet or, you know, and sometimes they'll end up in the wrong kind of places. So in that sense, they're kind of similar. But any time, you know, we're doing something to stay away from our partners or stay away from our family, things like that, that's when, you know, work can get really, really addictive in that sense.
Well, I agree, as well as all the research indicates the number one times that sexual addiction occur is between 9 and 5, the workday. So your point is well taken, that oftentimes people get bored and they will drift off into something else to stimulate them.
Mm-hmm.
And so here they are. They see themselves as workaholics because they really are driven and they're working hard, but they also get bored and they combine or fuse their workaholism with another addiction.
Right.
So now, who were you thinking about when you decided to write this book? Who were you thinking about as an audience for this particular book?
Well, actually, the book, I started writing the book as kind of a personal journal, and then I found these 13 character traits that people need to be successful, and I kind of blended in, you know, my whole story into this. So it's really for anybody who wants to create more balance in their work and personal life, or people in a recovery process, you know, for workaholism, work addiction, And anybody who just wants to have a more spiritual journey around work and understand that, you know, you need to have a little bit of fun and not to feel so guilty if you take off an hour, you know, at night or during the day to do something for yourself. In other words, it really goes back to the idea of trust. If we trust, like in any addiction, you know, like if we trust in a higher power that, you know, we're making as much money as we're supposed to and we're doing what we're supposed to be doing, then everything is going to work out, in its place.
Absolutely. Now, when you referenced spiritual journey, what do you mean by that?
Well, spiritual journey, there's a lot of, let me just get my note here, 1 second.
Sure.
I just wanted to find this quote because it's really nice. It's in the book, but it says, "We are meant to be addicted to God, but we develop secondary addictions that temporarily appear to fix our problems." So the idea is that spirituality means the idea of perfecting our character traits, and so to be spiritual, we want to perfect that idea that I'm going to accept what my lot in life is right now. And it doesn't mean that we can't, you know, we shouldn't switch jobs if we don't like it. Or it doesn't mean that we shouldn't work hard, especially as entrepreneurs. You know, we have to still put in the effort, you know, to make something happen. But in order to have a mindful presence and a spiritual journey, we have to be able to accept the fact that right now this is what's supposed to be what is supposed to be happening for me. And then when we can do that, we can live more, you know, a balanced life.
Well, and so one more time, if you'd repeat that quote, it was, "We are meant to be addicted to God, but we are temporarily addicted to..."
So we develop secondary addictions.
Okay.
That temporarily appear to fix our problems.
Okay.
That's Edward Berkman, Berekman.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. And that's certainly, that's the solution, is that we're really meant to be addicted to God.
Right.
So in your book, you talk about the character traits and also about what that spiritual journey is all about.
Right, and there's some you know, stories in there, and you know, some interesting examples and other quotes and things.
Well, you said in the book that obviously workaholism is an accepted addiction. As a matter of fact, it's fostered. I remember when I was working super hard, my boss said to me, "Carol, we would love to clone you because you work the work of 4 or 5 people."
Mm-hmm.
And A, I really loved that admiration and that appreciation of who I was. Obviously, I had some work to do on myself because that meant a lot to me. And then B, you know, obviously the adrenaline high from working so hard was part of the medication that helped me not deal with some feelings that I needed to deal with a long time ago. So what did you find out about yourself? As you said, this was kind of a personal journey for you. Were you, too, addicted to work?
Oh, absolutely, yes. I have a I call it a guru addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was doing was kind of being kind of codependent on the gurus in the field. And so, you know, they would entice me with these letters and calls, you know, "If you'll only invest another $5,000, you know, in my program, this is going to save your life. If you just invest in another $5,000 and just one more success system, all your problems will be over and your life will be changed for the better forever," you know, all those kind of get rich quick kind of things. And so a lot of times we want to succeed so bad that we get involved in some of these types of things. And what happens is you spend money on at a certain level, and then you know, you do what they say, and then they say, oh, well, you know, we just told you a little bit about that, but now if you only spend another, you know, a few thousand dollars, we're going to tell you even more. We're going to tell you more of the secrets, you know. And so it becomes like almost a gambling addiction,
uh-huh.
where you're, you know, constantly, you know, I'm almost there, and, you know, in order to get there, I'm going to have to spend some more money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of fell into that trap, actually. Some of the things that I took from some of those programs I was successful with. So I'm not saying it's totally out of the picture, but you can get sucked into it by just continually, you know, doing it and continually looking for validation from other people. And that's what I talk about a lot in the book is, like you were saying, always looking for that validation and that, and you know, you're so this and you're so great and all that. And of course that does make us, everybody needs that and everybody wants that. But we also need, you know, some time, like, again, spiritual time. We need time for ourselves also.
Well, and I find that spiritual time to rest and just relax and meditate and be still is what helps to connect us to God. And it really is a disconnect when we're so busy that we can't even feel God's presence because we're dealing with the here and now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So then that was your spiritual journey. And again, just for our listeners' sake, what would you actually define as workaholism?
Well, workaholism is when the drive and enthusiasm for work turns into an obsessive compulsive work ethic, which negatively affects a person's social life, personal life, or spiritual life in a negative way.
Okay, so when that drive and enthusiasm for work becomes a compulsion and then interferes with your personal life and spirituality.
Right. Because especially as an entrepreneur, you have to have that enthusiasm and that drive to accomplish something, because they're, when you're working for yourself, you don't have a lot of people to turn to. And, you know, the success rate for entrepreneurial ventures is very low. So,
yeah, and it's 7-9% or something like that.
Right. I mean, sometimes it takes, you know, 4 or 5 years, if you can even make it that long, to start to really, you know, become successful.
Mm-hmm.
And so it takes a lot of drive and enthusiasm and trust and things like that. And those are a lot of the things I talk about in the book about trust and mastery and things like that. So you have to have those things. But it's kind of, I'll give you a great example. you know, people today have to have their cell phones on 24 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's kind of a haughtiness, you know, that I'm so important that I have to be, you know, available 24 hours a day in case that big deal comes through.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, people, you'll ask people, you know, how are you doing in business? Oh, well, you know, in 2 weeks this big deal is going to come through, and that's, you know, all my problems are going to be solved. And again, that's like a gambling addiction almost, you know.
I know. So what do you do with your cell phone when you get ready to go into a meeting or, you know, your kids' program or whatever?
Yeah. I put mine on silent.
Mm-hmm.
I was just, before I got here to talk with you, I was at we had a rally on anti-Semitism here in town, because we had a little incident that happened, and they had like a public rally. And I'm sitting there listening to these great speakers, and there's three teenagers, you know, in front of me, all, you know, looking at their cell phones. And the speakers are saying, and this is what I want to get across to the teenagers, you know, and they're sitting there, you know, looking at their cell phones. And people in business do the same thing. You know, they just, we're becoming a tuned-out nation of Einstein said that when people start relying on technology you know, for all their knowledge, then we're going to become a nation of idiots.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that really makes sense. Now,
yeah, that's what's happening. We're becoming becoming Google to death, and every all of our information comes from one place, and nobody, you know, reads anymore. So even in business, people are just I was always very big on, you know, reading my trade journals, and now that I'm a counselor too, so I read all the counseling trade journals, but I found that a lot of people don't do that, and they just kind of wing it through life, and so you don't know the quality of the information you're getting online, and so you have to be careful, you know, and a lot of the hype online can feed into this idea of workaholism and gambling, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, constantly going for more and more and more.
And so clearly, in your study of workaholism, that is part of the obsessive compulsion, is that you're constantly going for more and more and more, and you really believe if you just get a little bit more, it's going to make or break you. I mean, and so
right.
You're always striving for that next golden egg.
Right. And think of that as opposed to spirituality, where you're trusting that whatever is what's supposed to be. So there's that that's where you have to have that balance. You know, you have to trust, but you also
mm-hmm.
have to do work, but you don't have to go, you know, crazy about it.
Well, you know, that's a great segue into your book, because certainly one of the things you really talk about are the four elements of trust.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk a little bit about that and, you know, the character trait itself, which is trust?
Sure. There's a fellow that works for Inkscape Publishing, and he came up with this idea of the four elements of trust. And so the first one is, I will do what I say I'm going to do when I say I'm going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
That's the first one. In other words, this goes in for even with relationships. You know, we have to build trust back in our relationship when there's infidelity and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first one. It's called reliability. I will do what I say when I say I will do it. Number two is openness. I will share information with you that will help you do a better job. And number three is acceptance. You are okay with me. Who you are is okay with me. I may disagree with you, but you are still valuable as a person to me. And this was a great lesson for me, because I grew up in an atmosphere in school where if you disagreed with someone, you cut them off, you didn't talk to them. I mean, I saw that there was a lot of politics with the teachers and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And if people didn't, you know, if you disagreed with someone, we were taught by example that you don't talk to them. And it took me till I was almost 30 years old to realize that, you know, you can disagree with somebody, but, you know, you can still talk to them, you know. So that was one of my life lessons, and that's why I like these. So that was number three.
And will you repeat that one more time? Who you are is okay with me.
I may disagree with you,
mm-hmm.
but you are still valuable as a person to me.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's really about respect, isn't it?
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
for sure.
Mm-hmm. Got it. And then the fourth one.
The fourth one is congruence. I will walk my walk and talk my talk. I will mean what I say and say what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up as a teenager. I was called the king of sarcasm. And I was trying to be funny a lot, but as I grew older, I realized that sarcasm is anger, and so I never really said what I meant, because I was always I was very passive, and so I would be sarcastic. So I'm learning. Part of my continuing journey is to learn to be more assertive and just be honest and say what I mean when I say it. So these are all things that build up trust.
And again, you said it, that congruence is, I will walk my walk and talk my talk, and
I will mean what I say and say what I mean.
Okay. It's interesting because Patrick Carnes talks about how addiction obviously is an intimacy disorder, because you can't really connect with somebody when your focal point is addiction, whether that be workaholism, eating disorders, drugs, alcohol, sex, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But he also says it's a disorder of incongruence, because you are not able to be the person you want to be by virtue of the secret and shame behind the addiction. Now, with workaholism, you and I both know that it's kind of an accepted addiction. As a matter of fact, there's a lot of cultural businesses that really want you to work, and the harder you work, the better, in terms of their own cultures and norms.
Right.
So how do we go about getting involved with bigger business? Because I know that you're talking about entrepreneurship, but
mm-hmm.
how do we educate employers that this is not okay, and actually it's damaging in the long run, both physically, mentally, and certainly spiritually?
Right. Well, I mean, I think we need to educate people with some of the statistics. You know, our the divorce rates are very high. There's all kinds of infidelity in the workplace, and all these things are distractions from, you know, working too much, and being anxious, and being having a lot of anxiety about trying to, reach, you know, higher up on the corporate ladder. And so as we try to reach higher and higher, it creates more stress, and then we have to turn to these distractions to medicate that stress. But you're right. I mean, you know, like attorneys in the big, you know, the really big company, corporate attorneys, you know, in the big companies, you know, the first few years are like hell to them, because they have to work hard. And even like doctors, too, you know.
That's what I was going to say. Residents and
interns,
clearly, they sometimes work 24/7. I mean, they have a 24-hour shift where they're really not permitted to sleep unless they, you know, have a little downtime, but that's not programmed in. That's the exception, not the rule.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I think when there's a light at the end of the tunnel that, you know, this is only going to be happening for 2 or 3 years as an intern, and then I'm going to have my practice, you know, and then, you know, maybe I can take that Tuesday off or something, you know.
Mm-hmm. And yet, truly, I've worked in a health system for 16 years. I just gave it up last year because I wanted to slow down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful health system, but they are a believer in, we want you to see 41 clients a week. We want you to see half-hour clients. We want you to key it in electronically, so have that laptop on your lap. And you're multitasking and not staying in the moment. And let's face it, that is the number one way to disconnect spiritually, when you're multitasking and not staying in the moment and being present.
Right. A friend of mine went to a psychiatrist recently, and she told me that one of the things she noticed was that the clinician had a laptop on her lap and mm-hmm. never even looked up at the client, and was just constantly just taking notes of whatever the client said. So, I mean, that, you know, just as professionals, we both know that doesn't engender rapport very much.
Right, as well as it, again, makes you incongruent with your passion, which is to be there for the client. And, you know, I did that for several years, and I knew the system wasn't going to change. It is technology at its worst and its finest. I mean, their rationalization was, look, by putting this in, you're able to disseminate this information to anybody in the system that needs it, which is a fantastic service, which was true.
Mm-hmm.
But if I hadn't done it on my lap, I would have had to have stayed maybe 2 extra hours at the end of a 10-hour day, which wouldn't have been healthy.
Right.
And so I would look at my clients and not watch what I was doing, only to find my hands might be in the wrong place. And I was cursing secretly to myself at the end of a session when I saw that I was going to have to redo the whole thing. And that, for me, was a wake-up call because I said, you know what? That's really taking away from my passion and my purpose and my pleasure in being with this client. And that's when I said, okay, you know, this isn't going to change. I'm going to have to make some hard choices. And so clearly, you know, when you're talking about workaholism and passion and people, you know, I mean, so much of what your book is about is talking to people who are in touch with their passion for life and work, but it has still become obsessive. And so I would encourage people to listen to that intuitive part of themselves so that they can clearly pay attention to the incongruencies that may be occurring so that they can alter their life in some sort of way.
Right. And there's also this idea of of not trusting, you know, extremes, of trying to balance, you know, balance your life. Also, that I have something in the book called, I call it Beware of the Octopus. It means that, you know, once you become a presence in your industry, in your city or nationally or whatever, you're going to have all these people coming at you, you know, from all areas trying to pick a little bit of your time, you know, for advice or for different things. And so you have to, you know, again, prioritize and be careful about all that.
So then what would you advise workaholics in terms of relaxation? You know, we both know that workaholics find it hard to relax.
Mm-hmm.
And you indicate the play has something to do with the solution for recovering workaholics. So tell me a little bit more about that.
Well, what I've done is, I can give you a good example. I used to like to do build marble races when I was a kid, and so I went out and I bought a like one of these games for like a 10-year-old to build marble races, and I bought a roller coaster. It's like 1,100 pieces. You know, you stick them like these little Kinect pieces.
Right.
Put them together. So instead of coming home at night and when I have spare time just running to the computer or looking at my cell phone and wasting time, I go and I, you know, I'll start doing a little bit of building, or I'll, you know, play my flute, or, you know, I have a stamp collection. So I have a lot of different things. I mean, I used to come home, and if I were to, like in the summer, I would go outside and just sit for 30 minutes. I would feel terribly guilty, like, you know, I need to be at least reading a book or, you know, something about work or, you know, but just sitting here and relaxing is a waste of time. You know, that's what I used to think. But now, you know, I'll meditate for 15 or 20 minutes and I'll be able to center myself, you know.
So that's, you know, one healthy way to relax is to meditate and center yourself.
For sure. Yeah, meditate, exercise, find some hobbies that you can do, a really important thing is that a lot of people are not in the right, really not in the right profession. You know, they kind of have taken these are younger people. They've kind of taken the first job that comes along, and then 30 years later, they're not, you know, fulfilled with it, and so. Also, you know, spending some time just writing and contemplating what is really your passion? What would you know, like that famous question, you know, if you had all the time in the world and all the money in the world, what would you be doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, you know, that's a hard question to answer for some people, you know. But, you know, like the book, I'm a big fan of the book The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
Which talks a lot about this idea of trusting yourself and you know, when people want to do something artistic, you know, the parents or teachers are going to say, well, you know, you can't make money being an artist or a musician because there's so many other people doing it. But, you know, if that's your passion, there needs to be some way to work that into your lifestyle. So maybe you can do it as a hobby or something.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. And that's that playfulness that you're talking about,
right,
that also helps to balance a stressful life. Doing,
right,
something you love that probably produces the endorphins, the dopamine, in the brain, and works both the right hemisphere out, as especially when you're working too hard, you're probably left brain in it.
Right.
Okay, so now you spend a good part of the book talking about values, and you just mentioned, you know, looking at your passion and what would you do to be happy. How do values relate to addictive thinking?
Well, it, you know, in any addiction, I think many times we escape into addictive thinking and act on it. We do things which are against our values, and that's what happens when we, as addicts, we end up doing things against our values. So if I stay at work late at night, every night working, and don't spend time with my family or skip spiritual exercises or spend money gambling on the next deal, then I'm not really, I'm really going against my values. But, you know, process addictions, like workaholism, convinces me that it's okay, that I'll only do this one time or I'll just spend one more hour at the office. But we know with any process or behavioral addiction, we end up spending more time and more money than we originally planned.
Mm-hmm.
And so just like in the 12 steps, the idea is that the addiction is just the symptom of a bigger problem, you know, of anger, fear, resentment, loneliness, something like that. And so when we can find ways through our character traits to overcome frustration and procrastination and trust our intuition, then we can, you know, figure out how to master what we're doing and learn how to play and live a more balanced life. Because even as clinicians, you know, what happens is and as entrepreneurs, you know, maybe we can, one way to cut down on our workload is to raise our prices and have more clients but still make as much or more money.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Like become, you know, well, this person's charging this much money, they must be good at what they're doing. And you may have less clients, but you're going to make more on each client or on each customer if you're an entrepreneur. So that's one way of working less and making more money. And people don't even think about that. They automatically think that if I raise my prices, then, you know, less people are going to come to me, or I'm going to lose all my customers, you know, things like that. And you might lose some of the customers, but in the long run, people, you know, you get what you pay for, or the perception is you get what you pay for. Hopefully, you know, you will if you follow those trust issues we talked about.
Mm-hmm. That totally makes sense. If you are true to yourself and you work on the reliability, the openness and acceptance and the congruence, people are going to want to pay whatever they need to, and that way you can work less and get more.
Right.
So now, you have this terminology, and it's called addiction-induced elixir. And I was wondering if you could talk to our listeners about what that terminology means and how people are drawn into the promises of more money, a better life, and a wonderful future.
Okay, sure. Well, to some extent, I may be guilty of this myself, because I did draw people into buying my own products and services, and I used to promise them that they'll make more money. What's interesting, though, is that people buy the product or service because of the promise, and then they don't read the material or follow through with the implementation.
Mm-hmm.
So I used to sell this marketing system for dry cleaners, and it was about an $800 system. It was four books and a whole bunch of CDs and coaching and all kinds of stuff. And I found after a while that people just weren't doing anything in the book. You know, and then they call me and say, "Well, this is not working." I'll say, "Well, what did you, you know, did you do anything in the book?" And they say, "Well, no, it's still up on the shelf." You know,
mm-hmm.
So that's something interesting about people, though, is that, like, again, they're drawn to this idea of promise of making more money, but then they don't follow through. So you do have to follow through.
Well, wasn't that a rationalization for you? You could say, I don't mind charging this because people aren't following through,
mm-hmm.
and therefore it's their fault, it's their responsibility, and you didn't have to feel any particular guilt because, yeah. Okay, so how does that play into addiction, you know, and that addictive thinking that takes over in the minds of some people?
Well, I'm saying that, like, when I got into that, that was actually something that I learned from these same people that I was, you know, buying into their systems,
mm-hmm.
you know. But, you know, after a while, my therapist and my wife put me on a self-help book diet, you know. Don't read any more books. Don't read any more self-help books. You don't need to read any more business books. You know what to do. Just go out and do it. And I just kept wanting to get more and buy more and learn more and, you know, learn how to be this great public speaker and learn how to be, learn how to do internet marketing and all kinds of stuff. And I wouldn't stop. I wouldn't just stop and appreciate myself for my own, you know, trust my own intuition that, you know, by now, by 50-something years old, I know what I'm doing, and just go out and do it and charge for it.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, I just kept wanting more and more and more, and that's where the addictive part comes in.
Well, that totally makes sense. I mean, you did the very thing that a lot of your clients did in that they wanted something and didn't feel like they had it already within themselves.
Right.
Fantastic. So then you got on this diet that your wife and your therapist put you on, and you tapered the amount of self-help books that you were doing. You didn't sign up for any more programs on internet marketing, whatever. And it helped, didn't it? It gave you some clarity as you removed yourself from it.
Well, when I stopped doing it, I really started thinking about what my passions are, and that's really how the book came about. Is that I hired a coach a writing coach actually,
mm-hmm.
and she helped me just, you know, write down my ideas, not for the purpose of writing a book, but it was just to clarify my thoughts about a lot of different things. You know, that I was feeling perfectionism, procrastination, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing those, and then she would look them over. And, you know, after a few months, we realized we had some good material here for a book. So that's how all that came about. And then I got a lot of pleasure from, you know, helping people with these types of issues. And that's when I decided to become a counselor.
Well, that makes total sense. And so now in the book, you offer tips for sobering up, and they're interspersed throughout the entire book. Can you let us in on a few of them before we have to end for tonight? What are some tips for sobering up?
Let's see. I'm just scrolling through my notes here. I should know this. Here we go. So for sobering up is to, like I said, find a hobby or find something, you know, to play. In other words, go back and do some inner child work where you figure out, you know, what made you happy as a child, and go back and do some of those things. What a lot of people do is they'll take a picture of themselves at 7 or 8 and they'll put it up on their computer to remind them to be a kid again.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is to realize it's not about the money, it's about the passion. of doing what you want to do and the money will come. Value yourself and others. Value yourself and others will place a higher value on you. We talked about that.
Mm-hmm.
To be able to raise your prices, work less, but make the same amount of money.
And you may have to do that in chunks. I know for myself, you live in Tennessee, and I live in Indiana, and they're both fairly conservative communities.
Right.
And although I think I'm probably one of the most popular therapists in Indianapolis, there's a part of me that wants to pay it forward with insurance. And yet we all know that insurance can be an incredible hassle, and they dictate how much we make and what we do, what services we offer and can get compensated for.
Right.
And so one of the things that I've decided to do in striving for make more, work less, is that I've said, okay, there are five different insurance companies that I absolutely do not agree with their values, and so I'm going to take myself off their panels. And it's the beginning of a bigger goal. Mm-hmm. And that goal is to eventually decide, how do I want to market myself and price myself, still being affordable,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, work less, make more.
Right.
And that's truly an entrepreneurial decision.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So some of the other ones are, don't take work home, don't
mm-hmm.
take work on vacations. I advise families all the time to between 6 and 8:30 at night, when you're supposed to be eating with your kids and helping them with their homework, to shut your phone off, and don't be texting and answering your phone or answering business calls, while you're supposed to be working with your kids, and you'll have a lot less aggravation, because your kids are going to grow up to respect you, and they won't be as wild pulling for your attention every minute if you give them a little attention at the beginning.
Well, literally, so you're advocating for a phone-free zone from 6 to 8:30.
That's right.
I like that. Well, my listeners can find your tips as well as your ebook at www.allanjkatz.com, and they can buy the book there. Is there a way that they can get a hold of you if they want to check in with you and consult with you for coaching?
Sure. My phone number is 901-359-8299. Or they can go on the website, and there's the email there. It's ajk@allanjkatz.com.
Well, Alan, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom, because this is also very important. And truly, my listeners come from a variety of places all over the globe and go on to iTunes and find out about the different shows that I do. So, your word is going to be spreading through the country. I so appreciate it. I loved your book, and I would highly recommend that everybody get it. So
thank you
so much for spending some time with me tonight.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed it.
Okay, Alan, you take care, and I hope to meet you soon.
Okay, me too. Thank you.
All right. Have a good one.
Bye.
And again, I would highly recommend his book, and that is Addictive Entrepreneurship. And then it's How to Achieve Success with the Character Traits You Already Have.
Right.
He's here to remind us that clearly, you already have these character traits, so it's very, very important to look at yourself, create a balance, work on the four character traits of trust, reliability, openness, acceptance, and congruence, and be the best person you can be. Okay, that's all we have for tonight, but as I always tell you, there'll only be one of you at all times. Fearlessly have the courage to be yourself. And tune in next week for Rob Weiss, the founding director of SRI, head of programming for The Ranch, And he's going to be talking about addiction and different programs that you can get involved with to enhance your recovery. Have a great week.